When veterans return from active duty, transitioning back to civilian life is challenging. The NGO Team Rubicon puts veterans back on the front lines, responding to disasters and renewing their sense of purpose. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In the first half hour, a conversation with the founders of Team Rubicon, Jacob Wood and William McNulty. They will be at Grinnell College next week to receive the $100,000 Grinnell Prize. Then in the second half hour, we talk with Regional EPA Administrator Carl Brooks. President Obama renewed focus on climate change in his recent State of the Union address. That's all coming up this hour, right after the news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guests this half hour are Jake Wood and William McNulty, the co-founders of Team Rubicon. Team Rubicon is a non-government organization made up of U.S. military veterans, doctors, firefighters, medics, nurses, and physician assistants, formed in 2010 to provide aid following disasters. Team Rubicon is changing both the disaster response and veteran service communities by utilizing each to solve the other's problems. This model of challenging veterans to use their skills for continued service versus providing veterans with a charity is a new innovation in the veteran nonprofit space. Team Rubicon founders Jake Wood and William McNulty will be at Grinnell College next Monday to receive the $100,000 Grinnell Prize. It's a prize established by Grinnell College in 2010. The Young Innovator for Social Justice Prize recognizes individuals under the age of 40 who have demonstrated leadership in their fields and who show creativity, commitment, and extraordinary accomplishment in bringing about positive social change. Jake Wood and William McNulty, welcome to our program and congratulations on this prize.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you very much.
You were scheduled to receive the prize last November, I understand, but you had to reschedule due to Hurricane Sandy. Tell us first about Team Rubicon's involvement in the aftermath of that recent hurricane that hit the East Coast.
Well, I think Sandy caught everybody a little bit by surprise, which maybe sounds counterintuitive considering we were tracking the storm for about 2 weeks, but you know, Team Rubicon was certainly prepared to activate in its aftermath, but I think once we did activate and we had teams out from all the way from Washington, D.C. all the way up into Connecticut working to do the initial damage assessments and reconnaissance, I think we were all kind of caught off guard with just how bad the damage was after it made landfall.
Mm-hmm. How many team members from Team Rubicon were involved in that effort?
We deployed over 350 military veterans, but I guess more interestingly, we used those veterans to manage spontaneous unaffiliated volunteers. So they managed, those 350 veterans managed over 10,000 mm-hmm. Volunteers who showed up unexpectedly at our forward operating base in the Rockaways every day.
Where are these members from? Are they from states outside of the East Coast?
They come from across the United States. We flew them in from as far away as Hawaii and Alaska. Our partner, JetBlue Airlines, provided us 150 free round-trip tickets. And then we even had military veterans from Norway mm-hmm. Come in and help. It was an amazing show.
Mm-hmm. And so these are veterans, all veterans?
Primarily veterans. About 80% of our volunteer membership base is military veterans, and the others are firefighters, other types of emergency professionals, some doctors as well. But the primary focus of the organization is in getting military veterans from the post 9/11 generation to come out and continue their service.
Mm-hmm. And for this effort, Hurricane Sandy, what were the two of you up to specifically?
Well, we had a headquarters there in downtown in New York, and so we were primarily running the show from our headquarters office. Mm-hmm. We only have a staff of 7, but we did make it out to the Rockaways and to oversee some of the efforts of our teams.
What sort of personal stories did you encounter, perhaps hear back from your volunteers that perhaps didn't make it into our media?
You know, it's always really remarkable to hear some of the veterans, either through an email or when they pull you aside at the end of a long day of work, to hear them tell you the story of their challenges in reintegration into civilian life, and to hear them say what kind of impact Team Rubicon has had on that reintegration. And you know, we had a number of veterans come and grab us and pull us aside, you know, at the warehouse that we were staging out of, and tell us that, you know, everything from I haven't felt this safe, you know, since I got out of the military, to, you know, my life hasn't had meaning since I took off the uniform, and I finally feel like I'm doing something that's worthwhile again. Mm-hmm. You know, you can really tell that this opportunity to have a new mission and to have a new community of like-minded peers is really, really cathartic to veterans that are struggling with that sense of losing that military sense of identity.
Mm-hmm. What other disasters has Team Rubicon been involved with? I know. Why don't we talk? The initial one was the Haitian earthquake, wasn't it, in 2010?
Correct. That was the first our first response, and we weren't even a nonprofit organization at the time. We were just this. People called us Renegade Medical Response Team. But since then, we've deployed on over 30 missions around the world. Our latest missions were in Mississippi, the F4 tornado that tore through Hattiesburg, I think it was a week and a half ago, and then Georgia just prior to that.
Mm-hmm. So these are quick responses. Obviously, you can't see a tornado coming like you can a hurricane. How do you spring? How exactly do you spring into action when you have, say, a tornado like in Mississippi or Georgia?
So if you take a look at the Joplin response or any response in domestic response, we pinpoint exactly where that natural disaster took place, and we draw a radius, say anywhere between 250 and 500 miles around that disaster, and we pull in as many veterans as we can that have applied to be a volunteer within the organization. And that's the initial response right there. But for a larger disaster like Hurricane Sandy, exhausted those resources that we had along the East Coast, and that's why we brought in other resources from across the countries and people.
Mm-hmm. And on site, talk a little bit more about what your volunteers, the veteran volunteers, are especially good at doing on disaster sites.
Well, that's you know, our mission within the disaster zone itself is constantly evolving. I think most citizens can recognize that veterans coming out of the military have certain soft skills that they learn in that environment. You know, they have a certain level of leadership. They've led men and women in some of the toughest scenarios possible with great success. They have the ability to work in teams very, very effectively. They have the ability, just as important as leadership, they have the ability to follow. And these are all very important skills in a post-disaster scenario. One of the things that we learned during Sandy was that there's no shortage of goodwill in a post-disaster. The communities themselves, the church groups, the corporations, the small businesses, they rise up and they want to help their neighbors, but they don't know how. They don't know what to do. They don't know what the next step is. These people want to be led. They want to work, but they need and want to be led. And so if you show them a 25- or a 30-year-old former Marine sergeant who two or three years ago was leading a 13-man squad through Baghdad, they instantly gravitate towards that leadership, and they instantly begin following orders and falling into line. And with a good plan in place, a plan that has phase lines and objectives and criteria for success, you can very, very effectively work through the post-disaster response needs. Everything from in a hurricane situation, mucking out basements so that the black mold doesn't set in, to in a tornado situation, clearing debris off of roofs and that have punctured exterior walls and tarping them up to weatherproof it so that the rain doesn't get inside in following storms.
Mm-hmm. And I imagine because of their deployments in Iraq or wherever, that these veterans are not in a state of shock when they see some of the destruction, the injuries, perhaps even death.
You know, it's amazing. They're back on mission. And it's mission first, mission accomplishment first, and troop welfare second. It's literally they have a mission, and they'll take care of themselves second.
Mm-hmm. Bridge the gap is a slogan of yours. Explain what that means.
So Bridge the Gap is something that we realized, you know, when we came back from Haiti, we thought, you know, we are an organization that bridges that critical time gap between large natural disasters and conventional aid response. We can repurpose the skills and use the same things we learned in the military for disaster response to make it more efficient, to more quickly deploy. And so Bridging the Gap is literally that gap between the disaster and large-scale aid. Mm-hmm. But, you know, since our first mission, we actually went through an inflection point where one of our friends, one of our original members, took his own life. And he was a Marine veteran. He's actually Jake's sniper partner in Iraq and Afghanistan. And it was at that point, when he took his own life, that we took a harder look at what continued service means to the veteran. And we came up with, you know, three things: purpose, community, and sense of self. These are the three things that veterans lose when they take off the uniform. And so because of that, we shifted the focus of the organization from the disaster victim to the veteran. And so, you know, Bridge the Gap has taken on a more metaphorical meaning now to also mean we're bridging the gap between you know, veterans leaving the service and reintegrating back into society.
If you've just joined us, my guests this half hour are William McNulty and Jake Wood. They are the co-founders of Team Rubicon. It's a non-government organization made up of primarily U.S. military veterans to provide aid following disasters. And they will be at Grinnell College this next week to receive the $100,000 Grinnell Prize for creating this entity. Tell us a little bit about your backgrounds, Jake and Will, if you could. Military backgrounds?
Well, I guess my background, it might be a little bit relevant to this show. I grew up just about an hour and a half away from Grinnell down in Bettendorf, Iowa.
And this is Will or Jake?
This is Jake, sorry.
Okay, Jake, okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I grew up about an hour and a half away in Bettendorf, Iowa, and so I've got, you know, close roots to the state. I ended up joining the Marine Corps out of college. I went to the University of Wisconsin and joined the Marine Corps in 2005. I enlisted into the infantry, served a tour in Iraq with the surge. And in 2007, and then was moved into the sniper platoon and did a tour in Afghanistan in the Helmand Valley in 2008.
Mm-hmm. So you were trained as a sniper?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any specific issues to deal with once you came back to the States after your tour?
You know, coming back, the one thing that was tough was coping with the fact that many of the guys that I had served with overseas were still in, and they were preparing to go back on more deployments, and that was kind of hard for me to deal with. But, you know, Team Rubicon happened so quickly after I got out of the military, I really didn't have time to sit and think and dwell on any of those transition issues. I jumped right back in and immediately regained that new mission and that new community.
Mm-hmm. Were it not for creating a Team Rubicon, do you imagine, Jake, you would have had some problems?
You know, I wouldn't go so far as to say that. You know, I think that everybody handles the experiences of combat differently. And so, you know, like any combat veteran, I deal with some things. You know, I certainly dwell on the Survivors Guild for the friends that we lost over there. And you know, there are certainly things that will happen throughout the day that may remind me of some of my experiences in combat. But are they debilitating or do they affect my day-to-day life? No, they don't. I mean, the biggest effect that I've had is the fact that one of my best friends did suffer it to a greater degree, and he took his own life. And that's really been the hardest part of transition for me is losing friends to suicide after the fact.
Will McNulty, tell us a little bit about your background prior to Team Rubicon.
Sure. So I grew up in Chicago. I was born in Evanston, so not far away, a state over from here. And I went to the University of Kansas, enlisted after graduating from Kansas, and into the Marines. I became an anti-tank missileman or a tow gunner. I spent 8 years in the reserves. I deployed to Iraq as a civilian for about 23 months on two separate tours. And then getting out, I continued to work in the intelligence community, and I worked in the intelligence community up until I started Team Rubicon with Jake.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the point you mentioned a couple of times about the suicide prevention among veterans. On average, 18 veterans commit suicide every day, according to some statistics I have. 37% of veterans self-report symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. Talk a little bit more about how being part of Team Rubicon helps veterans with these mental health problems. What is exactly going on, do you believe?
Well, your figure is actually a little bit off. There's a new study that just came out by the VA, and it's they've upped it to 22 military veterans commit suicide every day. So this is a national emergency that that's not being given the attention that it needs. And you know, through Team Rubicon's service, like I said, we identified those three things, but community and mission are hugely important, and there's a way, there's a difference in the way that veterans reintegrate today. And you know, military units are piecemealed together, and then when they get out of the service, they take off the uniform, they go back to their hometowns, and they lose that connection, that esprit de corps, that camaraderie that they had with the people they served with. And so, what we are trying to do is recreate that community through these disaster response projects.
Mm-hmm. Do you also integrate mental health professionals inside your organization?
That's something that we're beginning to do. It's a gap that we realized that we owe a solution there for our volunteers. You know, we haven't really been exposed to a slew of mental health problems within our volunteer base. We have had a few recently, but we are partnering with other organizations. You know, listen, we are first and foremost a disaster response organization. We're not a mental health organization, and so we're not going to try to reinvent the wheel there. We're looking for partners who are best in class that can help support our efforts, because you know, there isn't just the mental health issue of veterans who may be involved with Team Rubicon. There's the mental health issues of the victims of the disasters that we're going to as well. And so, you know, a post-disaster scenario creates all of these mental health exposures and risks. And so we are partnering with other organizations like Given Hour and Headstrong Project to help meet those needs. Mm-hmm.
Jake Wood and Will McNulty are with me, co-founders of Team Rubicon, a non-governmental organization made up of primarily U.S. veterans to provide aid following disasters. It's been in existence since 2010, and they will be receiving, Team Rubicon will be receiving the $100,000 Grinnell Prize next week. What if someone is listening who thinks he or she may want to become involved with Team Rubicon? What sort of people are you looking for? You choose them, right?
Well, we're looking for we've done very, very little outreach, and basically it's been a lot by word of mouth, and they've seen a media piece, and if someone was interested, we have it's not just veterans and other first responders like doctors and nurses and firemen, we have lawyers, accountants, graphic design artists, you name it, donating their time to Team Rubicon. And it's really important to identify those people as well, because you know, we're broken down into 10 regions across the country. So we have 10 regions with 4 regional directors in each region, and everyone needs support tailored to that region. So if anyone out there was interested in donating their time, I would encourage them to contact us through our website, and if you're a veteran or first responder, to volunteer through the volunteer button that's on the main page of TeamRubiconUSA.org.
TeamRubiconUSA.org is the website to find out more information. It's made up of volunteers, but there are certainly plenty of costs for transportation, for equipment, and so on. How is that covered?
Well, you know, over the course of the last 3 years, you know, we've grown both in size and scope of the disasters we respond to, but also the size and scope of our budget. And when we first began with that first mission in Haiti, we really leveraged social media to help cover the costs. And like William mentioned earlier, we weren't even a nonprofit organization at the time. We were really being supported by grassroots efforts of friends and family who trusted us enough to donate to our PayPal account. And you know, we really, as a young, flexible organization, decided to leverage the power of social media to spread the word of what it was we were doing. And through social media, over the course of our first 2 years, we had a tremendous amount of success through that grassroots fundraising effort. So we, you know, over the first 2 years, nearly 100% of our proceeds came from or through social media. Last year in 2012, as the organization matured and as foundations and corporations finally began to view us as a long-term solution to both the veteran reintegration piece and disaster response, we started to get some corporate support. And so last year, our donations revenue was split about 50-50 between grassroots, you know, the individual citizen, and the corporation.
How many disasters, again, would you say Team Rubicon has been involved in over the years, in the tens?
Right now we're about at 37 with the last two that we've responded to in Georgia and Mississippi.
Such a young organization growing so quickly. Undoubtedly there have been lessons you have learned. What would you say those are, a few of them?
Make sure that you have the right people on board early. You know, we've built an absolutely incredible team that has taken this organization to levels that I don't think in 2010 we ever thought were possible. And it's been because of incredible people, people that have other full-time jobs and volunteer into the late hours of the night to help grow this organization, people that have made tremendous sacrifices professionally and personally to take full-time positions within the organization. I think that you can never underestimate the power of having the right people on board and making sure that you're keeping the wrong people off. That's equally important.
And when you have those people, trust them, empower them, and support them as they go out and do this work on behalf of the organization, because it's not always easy to show up to a disaster when you're not a very well-known organization. People look at you skeptically, but by the work that we do, we demonstrate our value, and so we invest in our people heavily.
Got just a minute or so left. The Grinnell Prize, $100,000, comes with that. You'll be receiving it next week. Do you have plans for the money?
Well, this year we're really focused on investing in training. You know, we have about 8,000 volunteers across the country right now. And as our organization grows and the scope of what we do in the disaster zone grows and expands, training is really important. And primarily we want to focus that training on the key leaders within the organization at the regional, the state, and the local level, as well as those team leaders that are actually taking the teams out into the field. So we're really focused on that in 2013. We think it's going to help create a better framework through which more people can get involved spontaneously whenever it is that it's appropriate for them in their life. So really what we're trying to do is bring the right people on board to develop and manage that training pipeline.
Very quickly, before we have to say goodbye, what do you imagine for Team Rubicon in 5 or 10 years?
Well, we want to both be the premier veteran service organization, just for maybe a lack of a better way of putting it, the new model of veteran integration, whereas the old model was the American Legion, the VFW, as well as a first-rate disaster response organization.
Mm-hmm. Jake Wood and William McNulty, thank you very much for joining us, the co-founders of Team Rubicon. Thank you so much for your service to our country in the military and in this great new organization.
Well, thank you very much for having us, for giving us the opportunity to spread the word.
Thank you. We're honored to be here at Grinnell.
This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. When we come back after a short break, we'll talk with regional EPA Administrator Carl Brooks and ask him about President Obama's renewed focus on climate change. He mentioned that in his recent State of the Union address. That's when we continue. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. So good to have you with us on this snowy Friday afternoon. I'm Ben Kiefer. A few days ago, President Obama renewed focus on climate change in his State of the Union address. Here's some of what he's had to say about it.
It's true that no single event makes a trend. But the fact is, the 12 hottest years on record have all come in the last 50. Heat waves, droughts, wildfires, floods, all are now more frequent and more intense. We can choose to believe that Superstorm Sandy and the most severe drought in decades and the worst wildfires some states have ever seen were all just a freak coincidence. Or we can choose to believe in the overwhelming judgment of science and act before it's too late.
Emphatic remarks from the president in his latest State of the Union address a few days ago. His words were remarkable in that climate change was not emphasized in his 2012 campaign. In fact, the words climate change were not uttered in any of the three debates between President Obama and Governor Mitt Romney. Joining us now with an update on climate change and other environmental issues concerning us in the Midwest is Carl Brooks in our Des Moines studio, the regional administrator of the for the Environmental Protection Agency, serving Region 7, which serves not only Iowa, but also Kansas, Missouri, Nebraska, and nine tribal nations. Carl Brooks, welcome to our program.
Ben, thanks. Great to be here again.
I want to reach out to our listeners. We have Carl with us this first half hour. If you have a question about climate change, the EPA's involvement combating that, or any other environmental questions, 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. To keep with climate change as a topic, Carl Brooks, the House Republican chair of the House Energy and Power Subcommittee, Representative Ed Whitfield, Republican from Kentucky, says the EPA is in for a battle if it tries to increase regulation as an approach to climate change. What new power plant emission standards is the EPA putting forward?
In March last year, the agency proposed a new rule that would apply to new coal power plants that was directly addressed at controlling their carbon emissions, trying to get at the greenhouse gases that we know cause climate warming. The rule drew a lot of comment, a lot of criticism, and yet it was a pretty common sense approach. It's likely to become final fairly soon. And that was a rule that was made under the agency's existing legal authority in the Clean Air Act. So it did not require the Congress to make any additional changes to or give us any new powers. We're simply carrying out Congress's original directive that we protect the public against dangerous air pollutants.
Mm-hmm. So when the president would act to combat climate change, what areas can he act in without congressional approval?
Well, I want to start off with two of the most important where EPA, working with President Obama, has made a substantial contribution toward preventing and reducing the impacts of climate change, and they are in fuel economy and energy efficiency. Last year, the agency continued an effort to try to make American vehicles more fuel efficient. It obviously started 25, 30 years ago, but the biggest single improvement in vehicle fuel efficiency will come because of these rules the agency negotiated with the auto and truck industry last year. By the year 2020, vehicles will be twice as fuel efficient as they were just 5 years ago. That'll save us over 2 billion gallons or 2 billion barrels of oil per year. It'll be a tremendous increase in energy savings, and the less fuel a car uses, the less greenhouse gas pollutants it emits. So in vehicles, we've already done a really substantial job there. Working on energy efficiency is going to be one of the next challenges. The president urged the Congress to give us the authority to create what he called a race to the top for energy efficiency or energy productivity. That, we think, at EPA is the really great untapped opportunity to make changes in the amount of carbon emissions that we generate in this country.
Mm-hmm. For example, in what kind of areas specifically?
Well, the biggest producers of greenhouse emissions right now are in transport and essentially building operations, the heating, cooling, and lighting of buildings. So the chances to work with the construction industry, the lighting industry, and especially with states, which are largely responsible for setting electricity rates in this country. You know, each state has a utility commission that decides the prices and types of service that utility companies will provide. They have a direct interest in trying to make sure that utility services are provided, electricity and gas, at a reasonable cost, which means trying to be efficient wherever we can.
Mm-hmm. Do we know what effect this will have, what help this will have in climate change, these examples you're citing?
The impacts on climate change are obviously kind of difficult to say. So, for example, if Iowa promoted more energy conservation, that will have this measurable impact on carbon emissions. We can track carbon emissions. It's harder to run through the model and say that's what it will do to the atmosphere, to the temperature increase, or to any particular weather event. But I think the president made it clear that the science is beyond dispute. We're past arguing about the science. Now we're into deciding how to take measurable actions that can be done in our time, and that's where the agency is going.
Mm-hmm. In that clip, the president spoke in his State of the Union address about more extreme weather, floods, droughts, heat waves, more intense and frequent weather. I wonder if the EPA is preparing for inevitable climate change, which is happening, according to scientists, as we speak.
Yes, just like every one of the agencies that reports to the president, we've been responsible for studying how to adapt to the change that we already know is going on, the stuff we can see all around us. And so the agency is working with local communities, with states, and with a variety of different private stakeholders on adapting existing systems to climate change.
Mm-hmm. And specifically here in the Midwest, in your region, 7, what would be at the top of the list as far as new things we'll have to get used to in terms of the climate?
I suspect that small water systems, especially in rural areas, particularly on the plains west of here in Nebraska and Kansas, they rely on relatively shallow aquifers for their drinking water and in some cases surface water supplies. Once you have steadily increasing summer heat and when we end up with less snowfall in the winter, those drinking water sources are going to be challenged, and those communities might need extra money to drill deeper wells. They might need to be able to build a slightly larger water reservoir, and they might need infrastructure improvements so their pipes and pumps and systems handle that water better. That's probably one of the best things that we can do.
Mm-hmm. Well, Will, a listener posting on our Facebook page, writes, asks you the question, if you could get the legislature to pass a single policy in Iowa, I assume Will is referring to the Iowa legislature, that passes a policy in Iowa that addresses climate change. What would you want it to be at the legislature level here in Iowa?
I'd respond to Will by saying that the agency has a policy of not recommending the adoption of any particular bill in any legislature, and it would be arrogant for me to say what the legislature ought to do here in Des Moines. But I know that the state's development of wind potential is probably the most exciting thing that we've seen in Iowa here in the last 8 or 10 years. You know, the state, I think, is second in the country in wind potential and the fastest growing state in terms of wind generation. There are a variety of steps that every state can take that has those wind resources to make sure that that's getting available, that it's getting into the grid, that the utility commission is able to price it in a way that encourages the development of wind energy. So I'd say that might be a very useful step that Iowans can take, use the wind that blows across the prairies right now.
We've seen them pop up in such abundance over the last few years, the wind turbines, particularly in the central part and northwest part of the state. Do we know how much potential there is, how many more we are likely to see come up in the next few years?
I'm sure, Ben, that some do who are expert in the industry. I know that the American Wind Energy Association has detailed maps and charts and graphs about wind potential state by state and even sections of states. I'm not directly familiar with those, but it wouldn't be hard to find those. I'm sure that the Public Utilities Commission is aware of them here.
Mara, also writing on our Facebook page for you, a question, changing topics here a little bit, but the environment at the focus here. Doesn't it make sense, writes Mara, to restore prairies and wetlands wherever possible so as to help clean the water, soil, and air while filtering pollutants before they get into our groundwater? What efforts are being made toward that, asks Mara.
Eloquently put, Mara. Short answer, yes, it makes tremendous sense to do that. Iowa at one time, as everybody who studies this state knows, was a wet prairie. It's amply drained by rivers. The two greatest rivers in the continent are really part of the Iowa landscape. Wetlands, we know, retain sediment. They retain chemicals that are moving through the water. They slow the rate of water movement, which helps in flood protection. And the state has a really good opportunity both through the Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship, IDALS, and the Department of Natural Resources, the DNR, to work with willing sellers on those kinds of programs. And I know also that the USDA, through the Natural Resources Conservation Service, the NRS, is interested in trying to restore and recover and even expand wetlands where it works. And it works in many places in this state.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps you could expand, related to that, Iowa's list of impaired waterways is growing. What's being done there?
The biggest challenge this state faces, bar none, is to work with agricultural production, particularly row crop production here, corn and soybeans, to make sure that we grow the grains that feed the nation and the world in ways that don't release as much nutrient pollution into the waters, and also sediment too, but the sediment's especially bad because it's carrying the nutrients along with it. Nutrients pollute Iowa water. They make it more expensive for drinking water supplies to be treated so that we can use them. They make it more expensive for businesses. They can be dangerous to our health. Certain kinds of algae blooms can sicken or even kill us or our animals. And when they flow into the Mississippi River, they move downstream, collect with other nutrients, and eventually pollute the Gulf of Mexico, which is one of the world's most productive fisheries and America's most productive fishery. Getting a handle on nutrient pollution, primarily from land use activities, and bending that nutrient curve down stands before us as the biggest environmental challenge that I think the Environmental Protection Agency sees in this state.
Mm-hmm. Also related to agriculture, livestock producer groups are up in arms after the EPA released data on CAFOs. These are concentrated animal feeding operations, releasing data in 30 states. The data was collected by states, obtained by environmental groups through the Freedom of Information request. The EPA had earlier drafted a new rule to require the collection of this data, and livestock producers objected, saying it compromised the security of the food supply. Why did the EPA release this information?
The EPA released the information because the Freedom of Information Act requires us, like every federal agency, to be transparent. It was an appropriate request. It was handled, so far as I'm aware of, in a completely appropriate fashion. What's disappointing about this manufactured controversy over the last couple of days is that it takes time and energy away from productive work that this agency and our state partners like the DNR are doing with the livestock industry to make sure that animal production is a good environmental steward and an even better environmental steward. When people gin up these controversies and engage in the kind of rhetoric that you saw over the last few days, It's not helpful. And in fact, it's plainly inaccurate. The livestock industry last year urged EPA to work with the states rather than to collect this information on its own. We did that. All of the information that EPA provided pursuant to the FOIA is information that anybody could get from any of the state agencies that provided it, often with the click of a key. Most of these states are at least as transparent as EPA or more so.
Well, a manufactured, you say, that means there must be a manufacturer of this story, this, I guess you say hype. Who's doing that?
Well, it was unfortunate to see some of the national lobbies involved in livestock using the kind of language that tends to polarize this country around environmental and all kinds of other issues. You know, for those of us who live here in the heartland who basically want to try to get things done and enjoy working with people who have different viewpoints, it's frustrating to see coming from the Beltway in Washington the kind of rhetoric that drives people apart instead of brings them around a table to look for solutions.
Our guest, Carl Brooks, regional EPA administrator, and we have him for just a few more minutes. Let's get in this call from Bill in Sac City. Hi, Bill. We're running out of time. You have a question.
Okay, sure. Well, thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing.
Motor vehicles, their fuel efficiency goes up considerably with lower speeds. Is there ever any talk in the EPA about lowering speed limits to conserve fuel efficiency, or is that just a sacred cow that doesn't dare to be touched?
Mm, Bill, thank you. Done in the 1970s, if I'm not mistaken, under President Carter, wasn't it?
And President Nixon, too, even before him. No, Bill, there has been no discussion, which I have ever heard or participated in, about the agency discussing lowering speed limits. I think that is totally within the province of the Congress of the United States.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so within the laws you have now, that would not be something that the EPA could act on.
That is correct.
Okay. This, too, how do you respond to the charge in the news lately that the EPA has undertaken a policy of sue and settle, and this would be in which environmental groups sue your agency, and instead of contesting the suit, the EPA settles the case and then undertakes the action the environmental group was requesting through the court action.
In a whole range of cases where the agency is sued, whether it's by an industry or a commodity group or a citizen environmental group, agency lawyers try to figure out what's the vulnerability of the agency. Have we followed the law? There are many cases, and there have been cases involving Region 7, where the lawyers conclude that the agency did not follow the law as it should. And rather than dragging the plaintiffs and the agency and the courts through a lengthy case, we'll look at opportunities to try to work out a solution to that. The idea that the agency, though, is somehow in cahoots with environmental plaintiffs to come up with things that are ratified by sue and settle deals, not true. No such settlement like that has happened in Region 7 since I've been the regional administrator. That's not the way we do business. We work in a way that tries to make sure the agency's position is expressed by our legal team. If our position is not strong, like lawyers who represent private companies do, we look for a resolution. I was a lawyer for a private company for nearly a dozen years, and you almost always settle lawsuits rather than try them.
A lot of talk in the media, especially during this last general election campaign, about the cost of regulation and the fact that perhaps regulations should not be so stringent at a time when they cost something and our economy is struggling. Can our economy afford regulation?
The way to put the question, actually, Ben, is can we afford not to regulate dangerous substances that degrade our health and inhibit our ability to raise food, fiber, and fuel? I mean, that's a terrible investment, is to make people sicker or prevent them from getting healthier and degrade the agricultural resources of the heartland here. You take just the Clean Air Act, which is now in its 42nd year of successful operation. One of the best investments this country has ever made. By many calculations, by independent economists, for every dollar spent by private and public sources in controlling air pollution over the last 40 years, we've received $20, $30, in some cases $40 in benefits back. And those are real benefits that real people feel.
Mm-hmm. Give us some examples of the real benefits that would be paid.
Fewer hospital admissions. For example, the agency is now, for the first time in 42 years, regulating mercury and other acid gases that come out of coal-burning power plants. When these rules take effect, hundreds of thousands of hours of extra work will be done by people who otherwise would have been sick. As many as 30,000 premature deaths a year will be prevented. Billions of dollars worth of lost time will be avoided. These are investments in health and productivity of the American worker, the American student. So they're smart investments. Regulation costs initially, but the payback in the long term to our health and safety and productivity of the land resource is tremendous. And most companies also have recognized that making environmental improvements encourages them to adopt new technology that enables them to make their products or deliver their services more efficiently. So it is a win-win, although there are initial bottom-line costs.
Mm-hmm. How does your work at the EPA directly or indirectly tie into the goal of energy independence for the country?
One of the best things that this agency has done, mentioned it earlier, is working with the auto and truck industry to improve fuel economy. Every gallon that we don't burn in a car or a truck is one more barrel of oil that we don't have to import from unstable, unsteady foreign sources, or we don't have to drill for ourselves. So that has probably been one of the greatest contributions that EPA has made to making this country more secure and more safe. When the president says we need to move toward a green energy economy in order to be more secure and stable, EPA is part of that effort.
And yet technologies like solar or wind need tax credits to survive. When will they be able to compete with traditional sources in the free market without those?
I'm not a PhD economist, Ben, so I can't give you the actual time curve on when that's going to happen. Many energy resources in their early days received, you might say, advantages from different kinds of government policies that promoted them. Solar and wind are in that early phase. I suspect, though, since the percentage of energy generated by wind and solar doubled in the last 4 years, It's likely to double again in the next 8 to 10 years, that we're probably on the sort of curve right now where these advances in technological proficiency and distribution are going to start to be self-fulfilling.
Mm-hmm. Carl Brooks, 30 seconds left for whatever you'd like to mention that you felt got left out.
Oh, it's always a pleasure to come here to Iowa. You know, this state is the nation's and the world's agricultural powerhouse. EPA has always had a very productive relationship with ag producers and rural people all across Iowa. It's a great pleasure to be here. You guys do citizen democracy right, and it's fun to work here.
Carl Brooks, thank you very much for coming into our Des Moines studio.
You're welcome. Thanks so much.
Regional Administrator for the Environmental Protection Agency in our region, Area 7, which serves not only Iowa, but also Kansas, Missouri, Nebraska, and 9 tribal nations. River to River is produced by Sarah Bowden and Emily Woodbury. Technical support from Dennis Reese. In Des Moines, help from John Pemble today. Also thanks to Stacy Schmeidel. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. Our theme music written and performed by the River Monks. We always welcome your comments and questions about this program. Contact us anytime through our Facebook page, or you can write us an email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us, and have a great weekend.